The American History Podcast, Episode 7.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Morswick.
Welcome to Episode 7, The Southern Colonies, Part 2. Before we get started, just a few housekeeping issues. First of all, as always, if you like the show, please give us a review on iTunes or whatever platform you're using to listen to our show. Those reviews are incredibly important to the show and help our ability to keep it free. You can also use the Amazon buttons on our sources pages to shop whenever you're shopping on Amazon. You don't have to buy the actual book if you don't want to. Of course, you're free to do so, but as long as you enter Amazon through the links on our website, we get a small little kickback from Amazon, which definitely helps keep the lights on around here. Finally, the winner of our free copy of Brian McClanahan's new book, How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America, is listener Isabel Valadez. So please email me with your address. Isabel, just send it to Sean@theAmericanHistoryPodcast.com. All right, so let's just quickly review what we spoke about the last episode. It's been a few weeks. We were talking about the founding of Virginia last time, and I'd like you to keep those dates in mind. Remember, Virginia is established before the founding of the Plymouth Colony. You get the settlement of Jamestown in Virginia as back in 1607, and you also had the Virginia House of Burgesses passing laws even before the arrival of the Pilgrims. All right, so let's take a look now at Maryland. This colony was created when King Charles I gave Sir George Calvert, also known as the First Lord Baltimore, a portion of Virginia for the creation of a Catholic haven in the New World. It was hoped that Calvert would turn a profit as well. Remember, these are money-making ventures. Eventually, or that was what they hoped they would be, eventually the growth of Protestants in the colony meant that Catholics were a minority, even in Maryland. And those Catholics certainly did live in fear, at least to some extent, of losing their religious freedom. And it's because of this that you're going to get something called the Act of Toleration passed in 1649. The Act of Toleration guarantees toleration to all Christians in the colony, but instituted the death penalty for anyone who denied the divinity of Jesus. So, for example, Jews and atheists could be punished by death. I'm not aware myself of any Jews or atheists who were punished with the death penalty, but this is not my area of specialty, so I can't really answer that question definitively. But the motive behind this law was the desire for Catholics or of Catholics to protect their faith by granting a certain amount of religious freedom to others who were also Christian. And thus, Maryland becomes the largest haven for Catholics in the British American colonies. Now, while life was fairly decent for Christians of different faiths, at least from a religious point of view, in other regards, life in the Chesapeake region could be very perilous. Thanks to diseases such as malaria, dysentery, and typhoid, the average person's life expectancy in the region was about 10 years shorter than it would have been in other areas. Furthermore, half of all the people who lived in Virginia and Maryland did not live beyond the age of 20. Less than 25% of all men made it to the age of 50, while women only 25% of it would make it to age 40. Okay, so as you can imagine, immigration would be an important source when it came to replacing and expanding the population. Most of the people here who were immigrating to the colonies were men in their late teens and early 20s. But unfortunately, many of them died soon after arrival. The men who did survive competed with each other for the few women who lived in the colonies, although some women did come over as what were referred to as tobacco brides. These women were recruited to come to Virginia with the settlers paying the travel costs in tobacco, thus the term tobacco brides. However, the reality is that most men could not find a mate. There were far more men than women. Eventually, the population in the region stabilized, thanks to increasing immunity from the diseases and the rising influx of women. By 1700, for example, Virginia was the most populous colony. They had a population of about 50,000 people. And Maryland was the third most populous, with a total population numbering around 30,000 people. The tobacco plantation economy was at the center of life in this region at this point in time, and it was one which was in need of a large labor force. At first, the economy is going to be reliant upon indentured servants, and the first Africans who arrived in Virginia in 1619 came as just that, indentured servants. And throughout most of the 17th century, it was primarily white English indentured servants who were being used. This might be a little different than what you're used to. But remember, most African slaves did not end up in the 13 North American British colonies. They ended up in places like the Caribbean or in South America, like in Brazil. So how did this work? This was a system which is referred to as the headright system. And a planter would pay for the passage of a white indentured servant, and he, the planter, would then be granted 50 acres of land. And of course, he had himself someone to work the land. The worker would have his or her passage from England to the colony paid for, and then they would have to work for a designated amount of time to pay back the passage, the term usually being about 5 to 7 years. And so thanks to this system, landowners would acquire huge tracts of land. So what happened to the indentured servant after the contract expired? Early in the 17th century, they were often given some money, and in some cases, even some land as well as supplies to get started on their own farm. Oftentimes, however, the land would end up being in the backcountry, and the settler would have problems with local Indian tribes. They kind of took offense to people just moving onto their land. So later in the century, former indentured servants actually would be given little, if any, such assistance. And by 1700, planters had brought in about 100,000 indentured servants, or about 75% of all European immigrants to Virginia and Maryland. Of course, you can imagine that all of this expansion would result in conflicts with the neighboring Indian tribes. Europeans were land hungry, desiring land to create tobacco farms and whatnot. So eventually, the Anglo-Powhatan Wars, which is a series of conflicts lasting between about 1610 and 1646, would break out. And the result was the removal of natives from eastern Virginia. And so this leads us to Bacon's Rebellion. By the late 17th century, there is a large amount of frustrated former indentured servants living in the colonies. Many of them had come over with dreams of starting a new life, but they had no way to gain land, and so they were no better off than they had been in Europe. Many of them lived in Western Virginia and resented the planter aristocracy of the East. They were often too poor to own land and could not find any wives. Again, men are still greatly outnumbering women. Because freedmen were denied access to the land grants of the East, they had to then squat on lands in the West, where they often came into conflict with Native Americans. And so this would further stoke the resentment of the poor whites, who felt that the government in Virginia was not doing enough to protect white settlers from the Indian tribes. Now, not all whites had poor relations with Native Americans. Governor Berkeley was generally friendly towards Native Americans, many of whom traded with the colony. Of course, white merchants who were engaged in trade with the natives also looked positively on Indians. And indeed, the House of Burgesses in Virginia did not usually order an attack on a native tribe if that tribe was one which cooperated with the colonial government. So having said that, there are certainly whites who did not look favorably upon their native neighbors. And one such person was Nathaniel Bacon, an aristocrat who lived in the western portion of the colony and was also a member of the House of Burgesses. He decided at one point to take matters into his own hands, and he mobilized a militia to protect whites from the natives. In 1676, Bacon's militia attacked Indians on the western frontier and even set fire to Jamestown, which forced the governor to flee. So Bacon and his followers were opposed to the aristocracy, or what we might refer to today as the establishment, and Native Americans. In the end, the rebellion was unsuccessful, as Bacon died of disease and the governor was able to crush the rebellion. However, this rebellion has a major effect in the coming years. The planters would now see white indentured servants as too difficult to control and began looking elsewhere for a source of labor. You guessed it, African slaves. Furthermore, the planters would increasingly promote racial ideas to encourage poor whites to discriminate against blacks. The fear amongst the planters was that poor whites and the blacks would eventually align at some future point and could threaten their hold on power. Okay, so when it comes to the Carolinas, we haven't spoken about the Carolinas yet, so we'll go ahead and talk about them real quick. We must first understand the importance of the British West Indies and their impact upon these two colonies. We're going to talk both about North and South Carolina. First, the West Indies, especially Barbados, developed an economy that was based on the production of sugar. They had a sugar plantation economy, as opposed to the tobacco economy of Virginia. And in order to have such an economy, they too needed a large labor force. But they depended on African slavery much more so than any of the colonies in British North America ever would. Slaves in the British West Indies outnumbered whites 4-1. Now that's a significant ratio, and meant that certain strictures were developed in order to ensure that slaves did not rise up and overthrow their masters. First, Barbados developed and adopted slave codes in order to control the large population of slaves. Ironically, the slave code was supposed to protect the masters from unruly slaves and slaves from cruel masters. Of course, in practice, these sorts of laws provided far more in the way of protection to the masters than they afforded to the slaves. Second, because the island was in essence a sugar island, its sole purpose was to produce sugar. And so it came to rely on the British North American colonies for their foodstuffs. Now, one effect of this was that while there were small farmers in Barbados who owned slaves, they were slowly pushed out, and along with their slaves, they came to Carolina in order to farm. By 1696, Carolina itself would adopt the strict Barbados slave code. As for economics, Carolina developed both rice and indigo plantations east of what is referred to as the Fall Line, and this is where the flat coastal plain meets the Piedmont, or the mountains. Now, to the west of this line, you're going to get mostly small farmers and traders settling in, and they are going to displace the Native American tribes, pushing them further west. And so it's this group of small farmers and traders who overthrow the rule of what were absentee English landowners as they sought more direct representation. And I should note that this is a theme that we're going to see repeated again and again in American history. Well, a couple of themes that we'll see repeated. Firstly, the displacement of Native Americans, slowly pushing them west, and you're also going to get this slow movement towards direct representation. And I should mention also that by the second half of the 18th century, South Carolina is one of the wealthiest of the British North American colonies. All right, so let's backtrack a little bit. American colonization was interrupted during the English Civil War of the 1640s and Oliver Cromwell's Protectorate in the 1650s. During those two periods, you're not going to have a colonization taking place over here. The English are too busy. They're fighting amongst themselves. And new colonies would actually not be established in North America until the restoration of the monarchy under King Charles II. And at this point, the new colonies of Carolina, New York, and Pennsylvania are formed, and thus are sometimes referred to by the term restoration colonies. Carolina, there was not a North and South Carolina as of yet, as at this point, was created in 1670 and named after King Charles II. Now, the goal was to grow foodstuffs for the sugar plantations in places like Barbados, and also to export items, non-English products, like wine, silk, and olive oil. They also exported, unfortunately, they exported American Indians as slaves to the West Indies, as well as New England, believe it or not. And while we don't know the exact numbers, estimates run up to about 100,000 people. I should note, don't think that the Indians took this lying down, okay? The Yamasee Indians led a rebellion in 1715 against advancing white settlers and corrupt traders from the city of Charleston, who captured and then sold these Indians into slavery. Now, as I said earlier, rice becomes the main cash crop in the Carolina economy, and it was grown to be exported. By the early decades of the 18th century, indigo is the second largest crop in Carolina, and Charleston is the most active and important seaport in the South. It was a center for the aristocratic younger brothers of English families to come and try to get their start in the New World. Remember, the younger sons do not inherit, thanks to something called primogeniture. Everything goes to the first son. Another point before we move on, and one that I've hinted at, is the fact that Native American tribes and Spanish soldiers attacked Southern Carolina, the settlements that you would have found there. Both of these groups had a vested interest in keeping the English from moving further inland and further south. Now remember, the Spanish at this point owned Florida. And so that brings us to North Carolina. North Carolina was officially created in 1712 as a refuge for poor whites and for religious dissenters, and it would become the most democratic, independent, and the least aristocratic of the 13 original colonies. And in this way, it resembled Rhode Island. Economically, North Carolina depended on tobacco, which was its main export, and made it similar to Chesapeake. Another quick point worthy of mention is the fact that, for the most part, North Carolina and its colonists dealt quite ruthlessly with Native Americans and sold many Indians into slavery. And that leaves us with Georgia. It was the last colony founded. It was founded in 1733, and its founder James Oglethorpe. And this colony was created as a haven for debtors and as a buffer against Spanish and American Indian incursions from the South. Now, initially, Georgia prohibited free blacks or slaves from living in the colony out of a fear that slavery might take hold there. But this attitude does not last, and by the 1770s, it had plantations producing rice and indigo. And, of course, it used slaves to produce these products. And while Carolina had Charleston, Georgia had Savannah, which emerges into a very diverse community. It had German Lutherans and Scottish Highlanders, but no Catholics. And the colony of Georgia itself was made up of English settlers, but they were a lower proportion of the colony's population than any of the original 13 colonies, and it was the least populated of the 13. It had a very small population when compared to colonies, especially like Virginia or New York or whatnot. Okay, that wraps up our overview of the Southern colonies. Next time, we're going to take an in-depth look at Southern culture. If you enjoyed this episode, and I hope you did, please leave us a review on iTunes or whatever platform that you're listening to us on. Feel free to email any questions you have to me at my email is sean@theamericanhistorypodcast.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Sean Warswick. Also, please share our show with your friends, your neighbors, your relatives, anybody that you think could benefit from it. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.